Game on 2FM.
With Gillette. Great performances begin with a comfortable close shave from Gillette. Gillette, making men's lives just that little bit easier.
Thanks to Jenny Green for that phone quiz. I think it's the closest thing we've got to live sport in a while. I really enjoyed it, and I'm delighted for Jane with the big win. It's Thursday, the 21st of May, and this is Game On.
Coming up today, Jeff Shepherd on Kerry's kickers, who's heading to Georgia Tech, as well as his thoughts on the Last Dance series involving Michael Jordan.
We knew the guy was coming, right? He just needed the right horses to go along with him.
I don't know what we're going to watch next week, Jonica.
Normal people.
Yeah, I haven't seen that.
What?
We'll have the Bundesliga, though, and very soon we're going to have the women's Bundesliga. So Amber Barrett is going to be on the line to chat to us about that today. And we'll also speak to Olympic chief Sarah Keane to talk about Irish sports in crisis.
Game on 2FM.
All that much more between now and Tara Stewart at 7 o'clock. You can text us on 51552 or tweet at GameOn2FM. Marie, how are we doing?
Good, yeah. Pretty good. Yeah. Getting in the groove now. Realising sport is coming back. I'm pretty happy. Starting to look forward to things again.
Everything's competitive. I was listening to there about Jane, like winning the prize, cleaning the house, winning the grand. You're just like... But it's the rings, get me. I can't handle the rings. I'm there.
Ruby summed it up, I think, earlier in the week when we were talking about watching nostalgia and watching back old games, and then the excitement of when you actually get to see something like the golf, because you don't know the outcome. So I didn't know if Jane was going to answer or not. It was like watching a match. I didn't know who was going to win. I didn't know if Jane was going to win. I was so nervous, emotional. I was so invested. I don't even know Jane.
Imagine that, cleaning the house, landing the ground for the day. I was getting sweaty palms listening to it. And look, if Jenny's listening, is there any chance they could WhatsApp the winners? Just send them a message, because the ringing kills me.
Don't take it away from us, Donica.
That's true.
I'm living for it.
Yeah. We've a great show, busy.
Yeah.
A lot going on around the place as well.
Yeah. Good stuff too. Bit of rugby news. There could be some rugby coming back. Well, they have a plan in place anyway. According to Gavin Comiskey in the Irish Times, he's outlined some dates for fixtures. Imagine that, Donica.
Brilliant.
Potential dates for fixtures.
I love it.
They're quite varied as well. He has some in for the Pro 14, Leinster Munster, Ulster Connacht, 21st of August around then. The Pro 14 semi-finals, 5th of September. Champions Cup quarter-finals, September 12th. These aren't that far away.
Yeah, I think he's more hopeful than anyone else. I'd agree with him and love to see it, but I think Pro 14 is going to be so tough to get up and going. I think Champions Cup is going to be even harder, but I do think there's a realistic chance of an Interpro, and I think that was something that would be massively exciting. We heard Martin Murphy from the Aviva saying they could use that venue. Well, sorry, not use that venue, but that the Aviva would be able to be sports ready, and what better games to have in there than Interpros. And Marie, I've worked out kind of in my own head 14 quality games that I'd love to see, and it doesn't matter. Like, give me an Interpro where you see the Irish provinces bop off each other, and like, I'd be happy out.
So you've got a wish list is what
yeah.
you're saying.
Yeah, I do. And then we play the fixtures, we play the games that weren't played. So we play Italy and France, which didn't go ahead. We play them home and away. We kind of quarantine before we go over there. So there's kind of two more, and then we play a kind of home nations, the Welsh, the Scottish and the Irish, and the English. We might have to throw them in just for the sake of doing it up. But two venues, maybe the Aviva, the Millennium Stadium, and there you go, 14 brilliant games. TV would be delighted. Unfortunately, we don't get much supporters to it, but that's the price you pay when you're a professional athlete.
Just going to have to deal with it. Now, you sent me something today, and I think you were trying to torture me. It was an article about all the great stadiums, all the great rugby stadiums ranked. Yeah. And I just thought, why would you do that to me? Because we're not going to have fans in these stadiums for such a long time. So you sent me down this horrible hole of looking up great stadiums and great games, and
well,
it was sad.
It was mainly because it was in the rugby paper written by Brendan Gallagher, and I'll be honest with you, Marie, I kind of disagree with it.
Yeah, oh.
So he has put the top 20 rugby grounds, and look, we'd be interested in probably finding out the greatest grounds in Ireland, be it hurling, football, soccer, where is it? You know, I know Toman's special to the rugby crowd, but 51552, if you have a special, and what we're on about is nearly an emotional tie, so they've To be fair to him, he's ranked the Principality Stadium in Cardiff as number one. And as rugby, yes, 100%. International, that's the place you want to be. You play there every day of the week.
I saw Ireland, France there in the World Cup in 2015. Pretty special.
Yeah, that's...
Are you playing that too?
No. Thanks, rub it in. But he's got the rec and the rec in Bath. In ahead of Thomond, and I nearly took it as a personal insult. Thomond's in as seventh. I was there, are you joking me? Ellis Park is up there, and I don't think you can compare the international grounds, but I'm interested in it, Marie. Like, if we got a behind-doors championship, would what do you think? Crow Park, would it be a bit too big for it? You know, like...
You see, it's hard because you kind of have to pick a neutral venue, so... If it is a neutral venue, okay, there is the whole argument about the Dubs playing there all the time. But, like, if you give, I'd say, counties a chance, we'll say, Donegal, would you prefer to go to Crow Park and play in a cocoon or have Dublin in Ballybofey? Well, there's no argument there. So it'll be a tough one for the GAA when they do it. But I guess Thurles, Páirc Uí Chaoimh is another one, depending on where the teams are coming from. It's just trying to establish a fair system. But I was thinking as well earlier about all the great Champions League nights. You know, we've spent so many nights here on the show heading over to Anfield on a special European night, and you could hear the atmosphere with Ray Houghton and just amazing. I was there when the Man City game in 2018 when they had that whole scenario beforehand with the bus coming in and the people and the atmosphere I was stuck in the middle of. It was amazing. And that same year as well, I went to the Stadio Olimpico for the Roma game, and just the atmosphere is amazing. The fans singing, it was actually just okay. Liverpool lost, but it was just the most beautiful sound in there hearing the fans, and that's just not going to be there. So thanks for reminding me of that today.
But it's I think you've nailed it. The venues are important for the emotional ties, and that's why I didn't agree with Brendan in the rugby paper, because I think some of them, the rec, it's noisy and it's loud, but it's not any bit intimidating. You don't ever, same with King's Home, they go on, oh, people are intimidating King's Home. You're nearly laughing at them. You're like, it's just noise. Whereas educated crowds, you play in Claremont and they jeer and boo and go crazy at all the right times because it's an educated crowd watching the game, and that's intimidating because they know when to put the pressure on the ref, they know when to put the pressure on the opposition, and more importantly, they know to get behind their own crowd. And I'm
really enjoying your snobbery about crowds here.
No, the crowd's important to me. It's just some of them I think are rated because they might have a nice media box or they might have a nice corporate hospitality. I don't think that's the case. But I was just interested, if you were playing championship, would you want to be in Crow Park or would you want to be somewhere where you don't hear the echo or have to go looking for your ball?
Text us on 51552.
Yeah.
So another interesting story that caught my eye today was Seamus Coleman. And okay, he says that it's like being back training with Everton reminds him of his early stages of his career because he has to wash his own gear. Fair enough. He came through the League of Ireland. I'm sure he's well able. He said he rang his mum. It reminded him of it. But what I'm not sure about is when he says he thinks that everyone in the squad will be able to wash their own gear. I don't think so, Seamus.
Well, could you imagine that with Liverpool, with Klopp? He doesn't even know how to turn on the dishwasher. So, like...
And Seamus is a bit different because he came through a different system. But for anyone that's kind of came through any of those big academies, like, they weren't really washing boots, you know. They had everything laid on for them, the big academies now.
But I think hopefully it'll give an appreciation, because I know what happens in Munster. You'd come out and your gear was always laid out for you for every session. So it was really nice that it didn't happen in Munster, no chance. But when it's taken away from me, then you become massively appreciative of the person that's your kit man or whoever it is putting it out for you. And hopefully, you know, that's the case with maybe a few of our footballers. They realise, you know, it is harder than they think to wash your own socks or stop whinging when they go missing.
I'd say there'll be a lot of YouTube tutorial videos wash now. How to...
There could be a Zoom conference call, couldn't there? Just step one. Because I swear, Marie, I'm probably slagging myself here more than anyone, but it's paint by numbers when it comes to rugby players. I remember we'd be going through an airport and if you could ask us, where are we going? We were there, Wales? And they were like, yeah, but where are you flying into? We were there, having a clue, I'm just following all the lads in the green top.
So when you hear a story about a sports person turning up to the airport and not having a passport, you understand?
That's the ultimate fear. And then there's the cheek of kind of putting it back on the manager. How did he leave me not have my passport? Shocking.
Did you ever end up in the wrong place?
No, I didn't. But I do remember ringing Joan Moore, Joe Breslin now, Joan Moore, who was in charge of kind of logistics and planning for everything with the RFU. And I got lost in New York one time and I was there. I'm snookered here for getting home and I knew I could ring Joan.
So this wasn't a rugby trip. This was just a trip you were taking yourself.
Yeah. And I actually rang her. I was there, Joan, I'm in a bad way. I don't know how I'm going to get back. And she was there, okay, leave it with me and I'll give you a shout back. And she helped me out.
Right. Well, I don't know where to go from there, but I think it might be time to move on. Look, as we know, it's been such a tumultuous time for everyone involved in Irish sport, fans, athletes, organisations. I don't think anyone is immune to being affected by what's been happening. But now the dust is starting to settle and we were establishing our new normal and the future is starting to come into focus a little bit. But this is leaving us with lots of questions and lots of issues. So to look at some of those, we are delighted to be joined by Sarah Keane, who's the president of the Olympic Federation of Ireland and also the CEO of Swim Ireland. Sarah, how are you?
Good evening. I'm very well. I'm not sure if I know whether what day of the week it is or what time of day or night it is, but as well in the circumstances.
You're perfectly placed, Sarah, because the whole country is in the same boat.
Yeah, it's look, at least the summer is feels like it's here anyway, and we can, you know, get out in the fresh air, and you know, all that helps.
Yeah, it absolutely could be a lot worse. You could have been like Donica, lost in New York sometime, but no way getting home and having to ring an operations manager on a personal holiday.
Well, don't foresee us getting to New York anytime soon anyway, I'd say that for sure.
That's true. Every cloud, Donica. So Sarah, I was thinking about you earlier and just everything that's happened over the last few years for you with the Olympic Federation, what you've came through. You came through a serious crisis and it's really hard to believe that now you're facing another one in such a short period of time. How are you dealing with it?
I think really probably a lot of it is not thinking too much about it in many ways and really just dealing with what's at hand. I mean, look, what I find in sport is that when you're around people all the time who are, you know, looking to sort of make the most themselves, perform to their best, or even just learn a new skill, that you just tend to find the characteristics that they, I suppose, show and develop. And you just tend to find that you adapt to them as well. So from that perspective, for me, I think working in that environment all the time means that you all the time have to be ready to adapt to things. You all the time have to be, ready to think when things don't go your way. You have to also be ready to take feedback in relation to things that happen. So from my perspective, that they're all kind of useful traits when something happens that's not expected. You know, you sort of learn to be quite resilient. You learn to adapt quite quickly. You learn to be quite calm about it. You learn to kind of try and remain focused on the ultimate goal as opposed to necessarily the environment within which you're currently in. And I think that's really helped when any crisis I've been in. It's always, what are we ultimately trying to do here? And okay, the sand has shifted or the environment is a bit different but you know, we're still going for the same sort of ultimate goal. So let's look at where we are now and let's try and work our way through it. So for me, kind of working in sport and, you know, having been in sport all my life is probably means that, you know, I just feel that when you're in any kind of a crisis, you just have skills that really help you through it.
And I think, Sarah, when you look back when I look back from someone on the outside looking in over the last few years, your strong leadership was really evident and clear. How important is it now for organisations, associations, companies, clubs, everyone really, just to have that strong leader to look to?
Well, I think at the moment that one of the things that is very challenging for everybody is that we have a lot of people giving advices, and obviously we have a lot of extremely knowledgeable and experienced and qualified people looking at the situation we all find ourselves in the world in at the moment. But at the same time, there isn't really a clear path. You know, we're not definitely going to be here in 2 or 3 weeks, or it's not definitely going to look like this in 6 months or 12 months or even 2 years. And I think a lot of people are really struggling with that. And I think the part, I suppose, for me is that you just have to make some decisions based on where you are and where you think you're likely to be and understand that that's going to evolve and change. But you can't not make decisions and you can't not find a way forward. Now, I would also add, of course, that I think you need to listen to people in relation to that. But I do think it's very important to make decisions and move forward and work with people so that people then have some form of a path, recognizing, of course, that it's going to change along the way. So that to me is a big thing. And I think sometimes people can feel paralyzed because they don't feel maybe they have the expertise. This is unknown. We haven't been here before. you know, I mean, how is this all going to work? But you don't have to know all the answers to start your way forward. What I always find, and I'm finding it now in this as well, is like what I know now about the way forward compared to what I knew 10 weeks ago is just incredibly so much more. And you just have to chart your way through. But I do think it's important to be decisive. I do think it's important to make decisions and to say to people, look, this is what we're going to do in this circumstance. This is the best decision for us now. And I think then, you know, if that has to evolve, it has to evolve. But I'm a person who believes that you make decisions in life. And if you look back on something a couple of years ago and you say to yourself, God, you know, I don't know if that was the right thing for me, at least you can say, well, you know what? I made the decision at the time, which means I reflected on it at the time. So I made what I thought was the best decision at the time. And therefore, it's harder to regret it. Whereas if you just kind of bumble your way through without making decisions, I think you can sometimes look back and say, OK, actually, if I had made a decision and reflect on everything at that time, it would have been better. So I suppose my point is really, look, again, I'm so lucky in sport. I'm surrounded by fantastic people and very much work as part of a team and always have. But I do think making decisions is important. And, you know, within Stranraer and the Olympic Federation, we've made decisions as quickly as we could from the start of this. Be that, obviously, recognising, certainly with the Olympic movement, that we're part of much wider worldwide movement. And then in terms of Stranraer Ireland, recognising that we're part of the whole Irish sports movement. And therefore, you have to take certain decisions as well based on the environment you're in.
We heard today from Thomas Bach talking about the Olympics and the potential of it not just being, or of it being cancelled at some stage, that the postponement can't go on forever. What's your reaction to that, Sarah?
Well, I'm not surprised by that at all. I mean, certainly we're totally planning on the Olympics taking place in Tokyo next year in 2021. And that's the path we're on. But my own view is that this is the first time the game has ever been postponed. It has obviously been cancelled before. And it does make sense to me that if it doesn't go ahead next year, it makes sense that it would be cancelled. Having said that, of course, Thomas Bach was very clear to say as well that they are working towards the Games taking place next year. It's a mammoth task with all the different things that they have to consider, and they're going to have to just work their way through a lot of those. So there'll be no decisions made anytime soon in relation to that, other than in terms of the planning that will take place for it to happen next year. But I'm not surprised by what he said, bearing on where we are now. If he'd said this to me 6 months ago, I would have been surprised. But not in terms of the environment we're in at the moment. Because ultimately, sport is part of society. It's part of, you know, the fabric for many of us, of who we are and what we do. And, you know, therefore, we have to understand what's happening around the world around us and in the society around us, and realise that, you know, that's the ultimate health of our people and our nations are what's most important.
And is that challenging then for you guys, Sarah, when you think of all the planning that goes into Team Ireland, the logistics, the sponsors, just everybody gearing their lives towards this big event that you can't really be sure if it's going to happen or not?
Well, I go back again to these traits. So certainly the athletes are used to things happening that maybe they hadn't planned for, or they were surprised by, or, you know, things not going their way, you know, bad races, injuries, all these types of things. So they're very, very resilient bunch. And like their adaptability is something that I think certainly Irish athletes, we as a nation, can be proud of. I think their challenge at the moment is that they're seeing other nations back in sport, and a lot of our top performance athletes or Olympians or potential Olympians are not back at their sport yet, even those who would be ready to go back. Obviously, maybe some of the contact sports are a little bit further away. So that, I think, is a challenging piece for them at this point. In terms of the wider group, the sponsors, all the national governing bodies, everybody involved in Irish sport, I think that we have to deal with the situation we're in, and we have to plan to go forward. And that's what people will do. People will focus on it. It's something people have been working on for a long time. Because when you're involved in sport, as you both would know, you concentrate on the controllables. And that's what people are doing now. That's what we're advising, because ultimately, you know, and particularly I come from the sport of swimming, you know, you're in a race, you know, you concentrate on what you're doing, not on what anybody else is doing, because that's all you can control. And that is really kind of the message that we're doing now. I mean, that's what we're doing as leaders as well, as best we can. We're concentrating on what we can control. We're taking all the advice into place, and we're mapping a path forward, knowing that path could change. And that's the same for the athletes. I mean, I think they'll just be focused on, at the moment, the plan is for next year, same as they were for this year. And we'll deal with it as we go along.
Do you think that the athletes should, the elite athletes, the ones that are their whole lives are training and gearing towards competition, should get a special dispensation to maybe go back a little bit earlier than regular people?
I mean, I do. I feel very strongly about that, I suppose, because I've seen it happen in a lot of nations around the world now. like from Olympic Federation perspective, Sport Ireland perspective, Department of Sport, we're all working together in relation to this, and obviously Department of Sport will be liaising with the Department of Health on it. I mean, we have to bear in mind that, you know, the I suppose seriousness of what the nation is facing, and we obviously always have to be cognizant of that. But I think we believe that what would be required is feasible within the general principles of the public health piece. So, you know, suggesting maybe that some of the athletes need to travel outside of the 5 kilometres in their own cars and not meeting anybody else on the way, and then going to the venues to where they would train. We feel that would still be within the spirit, but obviously we are seeking specific dispensations around that. And look, for these athletes, the level we're talking about, you're talking primarily about, I suppose, carded athletes, maybe a way of saying it, or athletes who, you know, are funded to do this. So it's their job. They would see it very much as their job. And obviously for them, and it's, you know, at this stage, being back in their sport is essential in order for them to be able to do their job as they move forward. Obviously, as I explained, some of them, that's not the case for all of them at this point, because some of the contact sports may be a little bit further behind in that relation to that. But for those that are, they would absolutely see it as essential. And for a lot of the Olympic sports, if all of their competitors are back training at this point around the world, that is something then that puts them at a huge disadvantage if they're not able to be, you know, the level playing field starts to go away, and the whole investment, not just from a taxpayer's perspective and a government it's the whole investments that the families have made and the athletes have made, and you know that those around them are putting in, that's at risk as well.
Yeah, Sarah, just on that, I know there's other sports out there. We've seen the Bundesliga, rugby's looking to New Zealand. Obviously, we stay in our lane and do our own thing, but would you use protocols or procedures that they've put in place to get back? Are you looking at some of their return to train, their return to plays to get guidance?
Absolutely. I mean, our sport has been mobilising for quite some time now. Swim Ireland, we set up a return to the water group before the government's roadmap came out, and we were starting to talk to our other federations around the world, other nations around the world, other colleagues, both kind of on the coaching side, on the administration side. So from that perspective, we're all learning from each other and listening to each other, which is great. And when you have I suppose that's also the power of sport, of international sport, that you have connections in around the world and you can find out what's happening. So when the government roadmap came out, now just speaking with my swimming hat on, we immediately were able to sort of put our sport. So we've done a 5-phase for our sport, which includes swimming, performance swimming and diving, includes swimming lessons, includes water polo, includes open water, includes our clubs. And we've put that literally against the 5 phases of the government roadmap. Now, we're an all-island sport, so then we had to look at that in terms of the Northern Ireland Executive and what they were doing, because, as I said, once you're an all-island sport, that's obviously a big piece for us, that we're working to support all of our membership and all of our clubs across the island of Ireland. So we had that in place, and then from that then you start looking at the detailed protocols depending on what area of your sport is first. So for us, open water was first. We want then performance diving and performance swimming in the water ASAP. So we've written all the protocols around that, bearing in mind all the public health guidelines. We've liaised with the National Aquatic Centre and the Institute of Sport, all the relevant personnel around that. Then the next phase that we're looking at will be in relation to our clubs and when pools open in phase 4 and potentially in phase 3. So we'd be working with Ireland Active, which is the leisure industry. We're part of a 4 nations group with Swim England, Scotland and Wales. We're talking to our international federations, LEN and FINA, and we're talking to colleagues around the world around that. And because for us, you need to empower people to go back as well, because there are a lot of people worried, a lot of people have questions, and we live in we're involved in voluntary sports. So you're asking volunteers in clubs of unincorporated associations, so they've which means that if something was to happen, they could be concerned for themselves around it, to bring people back to sport. So in order to do that, you have to have some form of a very clear pathway for them. So for our clubs in swimming, we'll be looking at very clear protocols around it. But not just that, we'll be also saying, right, well, what are the declarations you're going to ask the swimmers to look at? What are the operation procedures of your facility to ensure they're part of it? What's your risk assessment like? What you put on your notice board in terms of ensuring people are aware of everything that's going on? We'll probably look at older swimmers going back before younger swimmers, because older swimmers can follow direction and therefore they'll be able to, when we tell them to get in the water and stop and start at different places in order to ensure that they're not too close to each other. We'll pilot with the older swimmers who can take direction before the younger swimmers. So there's all that side of it. And all governing bodies, I mean, Swim Ireland are doing it, but all the governing bodies are doing this with a view to empowering people to get back into sport over time and learning with our colleagues, because, look, nobody's been here before.
Sarah, the Federation of Irish Sport asked for a government task force to be set up. Is there any developments with that?
Well, my understanding is that, you know, that there's been work going on in terms of discussions, you know, be it Federation of Irish Sport, Sport Ireland, with the Department of Sport around, I suppose, the needs of sport. And I, you know, in terms of where that's going or what happens, I can't comment at this point, but I do feel that as a part of Irish Sport and talking to other CEOs and talking to other governing bodies, there is, I suppose, a level of anxiety growing around the impact this pandemic is having on Irish Sport and governing bodies and clubs and regions and, you know, and all parts of it, really. Now, the challenges are probably different depending on different sports and different sectors. It's not different sectors, different sections of sport in terms of, so I'll give you an example. With Stromarlin, we were running this summer a lot of national competitions and a lot of events. But the events that we were running this summer, we were doing them as investments, right? So we weren't going to make any money off what we were running this summer. So the fact that some of those things aren't happening we're not going to lose income this summer. Our income losses will come later in the year, which is really going to put us under pressure then. There are other sports that were running a lot of recreational events during the summer. There were other sports that would have had gate receipts during the summer and all those kind of things. So for them, potentially the impact is sooner rather than later. So it is a little bit different across sport, but it is very real, whether it's now or whether it's coming. In terms of the concerns, I mean, for us in swimming, one of the biggest issues we have is whether swimming pools are going to open again. And if they do open again, what way do they open again? Because the swimming is an industry, and a little bit like the restaurant industry or the pub industry, for example. And if you can only open and have 30 to 50% capacity, but you've got 80 to 100% of your costs, you know, what are you going to do about that? I mean, swimming pools can only change up so much. Like, they're not in a position like potentially restaurants where they can do takeaway or something like that. I mean, you can't do that with a swimming pool. So there is a real concern for us as a sport that if some of this infrastructure closes, that it'll never open again. And that could fundamentally change our sport. And swimming is one of the sports that's been prioritised in the National Sports Policy, which was launched in 2018, the first time in 20 years we've had a National Sports Policy, because of the amount of people who across the age groups are involved in it, not just in a club, in a structure, but just whether it's open water or whether it's you know, a gateway to other sports. So, like, this could have really, really serious long term.
Yeah, absolutely, Sarah. A massive life skill for anyone. But you mentioned the financial investment. What does that mean to your clubs in terms of facilities, coaches? Like, we see the figure so many times, but what's behind that? What's at risk for you?
Well, I think what governing bodies can manage and should manage and need to lead on is the area of empowering the volunteers to feel comfortable to actually go back into the environment and how they might do it successfully. Now, that is a massive piece on its own if you don't even want to bring the financials in. So if they have massive financial pressures on top of that, well, then the thing starts to become a little bit untenable. From our perspective, Stromarlin doesn't own or run any facility in the country. So that's a bit different from a lot of the other sports who do have those massive overheads. But swimming pools have fixed costs that are ongoing now. So whilst the pools are closed, the pools are being heated, the pool plant's being kept operational, all those sort of costs. And for our clubs to go back in, there's going to be things around, well, are you going to open? And if you open, if we can only have X amount of people in the pool. So let's say, for example, you would have had a squad of 24 children and now you can only have maybe 16. And like, that would be doing very well in the water. Well, then do you look for extra hours? And if you look for extra hours, do you have to pay extra fees? And are the coaches going to be asked to do extra hours? Or, you know, if you've got swimming lessons, which is one of the biggest source of revenue for swimming pools, and you can, you know, the capacity is halved, you know, you're not going to be in a position necessarily to double the amount of swimming lessons you run because the costs will double as well. So there's just, it can be quite complicated. But what we're trying to say to our members, because we're running webinars at the moment for our members, actually one of the first ones that is this evening in relation to this, is we're saying, look, the world is a certain way right now, and it could be in a very different way in 2 weeks or 3 weeks. So if you'd asked us 2 weeks ago how many people could be in the water in a swimming pool with social distancing, we probably would have said 2 weeks ago, God, I don't know if you could have more than, if there's five lanes, one person a lane. You're asking us now, we're saying that's very different. It could be twice or three times or even more, potentially depending on who's in the water and what way they take instruction. So that may change again in another couple of weeks as we learn more about all of this and how this works in practice. So that's probably the challenge as well, because a lot of people don't know what it looks like. But certainly, whether it's for the governing body, whether it's for the clubs, the cost piece is massive. And the problem for most people is how exactly it's going to work in practice is what's really potentially very scary.
Is there a fear, Sarah, that pools are going to go out of business, that they're not going to reopen?
There certainly is a fear of that. And talking to other nations, there's a definite belief that 20 to 30% of pool stock will go out of business and will never reopen. Which is just massive. So that's a massive concern for the industry, and we are part of an industry. Like, swimming is not just a sport or a physical activity, it's part of an industry. So that is without a doubt a massive concern for us. I mean, the other side of it though is we are trying to pull together this, I suppose, all these protocols and templates and science really around it, to encourage people to say, actually, do you know what, like, we think we can do this, but we've got to just do it maybe differently. So When our swimming clubs go back, or diving, water polo, they're not going to go back like they went back before, certainly not for a while, if ever. So we're going to have to reprogram how we do swimming sessions, what it looks like. The coaches are going to have to reprogram how they might have run sessions, and what skills they might have done, or what way they might have run training sessions. So that's part of what we're doing at the moment. We're talking to clubs about, well, you're going to have to talk to your facilities about what they want to do, because some facilities will open earlier than others. Maybe the public facilities might open earlier than the private facilities. Up north, facilities might open later or earlier, depending on their roadmap. So it's quite individual in relation to that. But I think a big piece of this is around recognising that, you know, let's control what we can control right now, and then we'll see where we are in a month's time. At the moment, in the government roadmap, both north and south of the border, they're talking about swimming pools in phase four, potentially behind closed doors activity in phase three, but we haven't got clarification yet as to what that means. And up north is step four, so it's similar enough. So we have some time. So what we're saying to people is, okay, let's just look at what we need to look at the moment, which is talking to your facility, understanding what they might do, because they'll have a whole heap of their own operating procedures in terms of how you walk in the door, do you go to use the shower or not, do you use a locker or not, all of that sort of stuff, apart from what you do in the pool. But what I suppose we're trying to say now is we're going to come up with what you can do in the pool. We're gonna show how we think you can do it in line with the guidelines, and that will evolve as we go on. And I suppose you're trying to also give hope to people and you know, belief to people that they can go back, and they can go back in a way that they feel comfortable with. Like, but having said that, people aren't going back with no risk. I mean, there is going to be an element of risk here for sure. In relation to this virus. So it's about minimizing the risk as much as possible. And then ultimately people will make their individual decisions as to around how comfortable they are in returning to an environment. But certainly we as a governing body will absolutely be supporting, going back to our sport, but we will be doing it within the relevant public health guidelines.
Sarah Keane, I think there's a lot of advice there that can be taken and applied to different areas of sport, not just swimming, but other organisations, associations and clubs will have found a lot in that. And hope is definitely something we can all take. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you. It's lovely to be with you. Thanks a million, guys.
Talk to you soon.
Bye.
2FM. Game on 2FM.
Maria must say, I really enjoyed that chat with Sarah Keane. Like, that's what you want out of your leaders, isn't it? Just the openness, the honesty. I just thought it was brilliant. Just
and practical, like you, advice.
Yeah, but it crosses every sport, doesn't it? It just, I found it great. And if you want to listen back to it, shameless plug for the podcast, you can listen back on the Game On podcast, available where you get your podcasts.
We've had loads of texts in about the pitches, and I love this one from Des in Clare, but from Limerick. We can talk about another time, Des. He says, let's go back to basics. We have no crowds, so we don't need pitches and seating. Let's have the rugby interpros at a club pitch. Imagine Munster versus Leinster on the back pitch in Thomond Park, or in Greenfields, or even in Clonakilty's pitch, or Limerick versus Clare out in Cratlow. Would be some crack. Oh, it would.
It certainly would. There's
talks
another
a lot
one.
Of sense.
Best cricket ground in Ireland, the Hills Cricket Club in Skerry. So we'd love to have a bit of back reference there in terms of why and what makes it a little bit different. Someone else is, of course, sharing the same lines as me, Marie. Thomond is a fortress and should certainly be second on that list behind Cardiff. I'd agree.
Yeah. Croke Park, Semple Stadium and Tom Clifford Park, Young Munster's home ground. Another texter is a big fan of those ones.
No, there's a bear pit to go to. Tom Clifford Park. I got my first run for con down there. I'll never forget it.
Did you lose a few scraps down there?
I didn't even kind of get the scrap. It was funny about it because I was playing with my brother, and I remember before the game had even kicked off, there was someone abusing me on the touchline, telling me how useless I was. It was my first game ever for Conn. I didn't even have the opportunity to be useless. I turned around to look at him, and he was like, "Who are you?" He was abusing my brother. He was like, "Who do you think you are to be abused?" So, a tough, tough place to go. Another one there, and the Giants Stadium in New York. Well, funny, we have time to turn stateside and join Jeff Shepherd. Jeff, one of our texts is here saying, best stadiums, Giants Stadium in New York. Would you agree?
Well, I mean, it's nice, and it's pretty brand new. It doesn't really have a tremendous amount of history, but to make things, you know, completely honest, it's not in New York, it's in New Jersey, which is a whole other thing. So they just happen to play, the Giants and the Jets play their games at the stadium in New Jersey. But, yeah, you know, Soldier Field in Chicago, and, you know, I'm trying to think, you know, so many teams have now kind of upgraded their facilities. You don't have a lot of these, you know, kind of like monuments. I mean, even Yankee Stadium that was around for so long, I mean, it's been rebuilt. And but, yeah, you know, Soldier Field in Chicago, I think, would probably be kind of like, you know, like the old school, you know, tough place, the toughest field, you know, in the country.
I was there myself a little good few years ago now, actually. I think it was
we beat the All Blacks there.
You did. I was going to say the Bears, but
we did. We did.
Let's trump that. And that text is from Tony in Tralee. And Tony in Tralee might be getting himself a Georgia Tech jersey because there's a Kerry man now gone to Georgia Tech. David Shanahan has done something absolutely unbelievable. He's got a full punting scholarship with Georgia Tech. Pretty phenomenal, isn't it, Shep?
It really is. Marie's the first Irishman to get a full scholarship to play American football, which is really phenomenal news. And he really did it. I mean, in a pretty, you know, I mean, look, you know, he was a teenager and he kind of came up with this plan. Like, I want to go to America for college, and how can I figure out a way to get it paid for? And he, you know, went to this kicking academy in Australia and tried out and stayed down there. And look, it's been an incredibly successful academy that he went to down there in Melbourne. And so successful that the last five of six. People who have won the best punter in college football award have all been graduates or attendees of this certain academy. So he's been offered a scholarship to play at Georgia Tech in Atlanta. The Yellow Jackets is their nickname, and the Ramblin' Wreck of Georgia Tech is what they go by. But it's really phenomenal. I mean, it shows you, you know, if you really set your heart on something and you find a way to go out and do it. Look, it doesn't hurt that he's 6'2". He can boom the ball.
He's got a nice kick, all right. Just watching him.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, that's obviously, you know, first and foremost, what you need out of your punter. But, yeah, it's great. And really just congratulations to him for kind of setting out on this course a couple of years ago and seeing it through and making it happen.
Shep, we know here at home that Kerry people can do anything when they put their mind to it. But how hard is it to do what he's done? You know, like, to make that transition?
Yeah, I mean, well, think about it. He has not ever attended a college football game before, or really an American football game at all. I was reading an article about it in the Times the other day, and it said, you know, his parents have been to a game, and he hasn't. And if the season starts, you know, this year, and I'm not sure if he's going to be going next year, but if it would be this year, they open up playing Clemson. You know, I mean, which is like the best program right now. Clemson and Alabama are the top two programs in the country. I mean, you want to talk about, you know, like an eye-opening experience. I mean, you're going to be playing against one of the best teams in college football. So it really is phenomenal. And again, I mean, it's not like he was in his like early 20s or, you know, in his mid-20s and he decided, oh, I'm going to go change my life and I'm going to go. He was a teenager when he started this process. I can't even imagine what I was doing when I was 15 or 16 years old. I don't remember it. And he's out here, you know, changing his world completely, traveling all over the world and making this happen. So it's just a great story.
It's amazing, though, obviously not brought up in it. Like, how will Georgia Tech support him? What could he expect around that environment? Or is it cruel, Shep? If you're not good enough, you're out.
No, it's not anything like that. I mean, you know, he'll have a scholarship. And I mean, look, there'll be a couple of others. So the way it works with American football is kickers are kind of their own separate animals. I mean, they pretty much kind of just run in their own circles with special teams units. I mean, and they practice, you know, field goals, punts, and kickoffs. I mean, that's pretty much all they're going to do. Every once in a while, they get in on a tackling drill because every once in a while, they have to make a tackle. But no, I mean, he'll get full support. And look, Georgia Tech plays in the ACC. It's the Atlantic Coast Conference. It's schools all up and down the Eastern Seaboard. So he'll play in places like Miami, you know, all in North Carolina. He'll play in Syracuse, New York. You know, he'll play all up in Virginia and those types of areas. So, I mean, theoretically, I mean, look, I mean, there are direct plane flights from Dublin to Atlanta all the time, you know, normally. I mean, in a future world, there will be. And so it's, you know, not going to be far-fetched that if you wanted to go and, you know, spend some time in America to watch him, you know, play a game or two, you'd be able to do that.
Well, that's me and Dunner sorted for a team now for next season. I can't wait. Shep, the last dance backlash has arrived. Horace Grant, he says there's loads of lies in it. What do you reckon?
Well, yeah, he kind of got blamed, you know, for the, you know, spilling all of the juice in that book, The Jordan Rules, which at the time when it came out, I mean, I remember being, you know, in high school when that book came out. And, you know, it was really kind of about how, you know, Michael lived and played by his own rules. And, you know, Michael even said it in the documentary that, you know, he felt like it was Horace Grant who kind of, you know, gave that reporter all of the background information. And Horace, you know, said he wasn't the guy and, you know, would have loved to had an opportunity to talk to Michael about this, you know, one-on-one, man-to-man setting differently. And I don't think he really took too kindly to being blamed for that and, you know, some of the other things that were alluded to in the documentary. But, I mean, outside of that, look, I mean, nothing's going to be perfect. I mean, and I think we all saw that even with Michael Jordan, I mean, it's not that he's perfect. I mean, we saw why he's great. But look, it came at the expense, and he even admitted it. It came at the expense of relationships with his teammates, relationships with his family members. I mean, he was just all driven, all consumed. And look, I mean, it's kind of an unfortunate thing in this world. I mean, like, nice guys don't always make it to the top. I mean, you've got to be kind of hard-nosed. I mean, nobody's, you know, Donners, nobody's going to be really nice in a scrum and be like, oh, excuse me, gentlemen, can I get the ball, please? No, you got to go in there and, like, hit somebody, right? I mean, that's kind of how the world works. And it was just a fascinating, you know, deep look into the life of Michael Jordan.
Shep, I could have cried Monday morning when I finished it. It just, maybe the absence of sport, but for the last few weeks, it's just been enthralling, hasn't it? How did you find watching it?
Oh, I thought it was phenomenal. And I watched it, you know, my wife and I were watching it. And I knew a lot of the stories. I didn't know everything. But, I remembered all the highlights. And I didn't really know all of the backstory. But it was interesting to just kind of to hear so many people talking about, like, you know, even, you know, Steve Kerr, who got into a fight with Jordan in practice one day, he was like, it was probably the best thing that ever happened, you know, because he got respect in Michael Jordan's eyes and Kerr was able to stand up for himself. And look, now he's the coach of the Golden State Warriors and they've obviously been phenomenal for the last couple of years. And even some of the other players, Scottie Pippen and Will Perdue, talking about, look, Michael was mean. Like, he was not a great guy to be around, but he demanded so much. And at the end, it turned them all into better players. Look, I think if you watched it, you know, the last two times that they played for the finals against the Jazz, I mean, they probably weren't the best team on the court, you know? I mean, it just, but it was one of those things where the whole was better than the sum of the parts. I mean, it just was. And all of that was because they were driven by to be better individually by Michael Jordan. And, you know, I don't necessarily think it works in every situation to kind of have this dictator, you know, getting in everybody's face and causing problems, but in that situation, it clearly did.
Yeah,
and Shep, I don't know how y'all feel about it, but is it still not mind blowing to think that the owner and the general manager would just let that dynasty fall apart without them trying to defend it on the court? Is that just not? Is that
sport politics? Oh, it's never happens.
But not even to have the conversation for Michael to be handed the iPad and for him to hear it for the first time is crazy. Shep, we could go on about it all evening, but we have to move on. Will you keep an eye out for Dave Shanahan? Look out for him out there, stateside. Hopefully, he'll be great. But thanks for joining us as ever.
Appreciate it, guys.
Game on 2FM.
Now, welcome back to Game On to boxing news. And it was announced today that boxing promotions company MTK has entered into a partnership with Daniel Kenahan and KHK Sports to stage the world's biggest boxing and combat sports events in the Middle East. We spoke to RT crime correspondent Paul Reynolds and Gavin Casey of The 42 about this earlier in the week. We spoke about the reinvention of Daniel Kenahan, how it was starting to happen. And this partnership seems like another step in the process. We'll be keeping an eye on this story over the next few weeks. Now, moving on to football. In Ireland, international and FC Cologne player Amber Barrett returned to training in the Bundesliga ahead of a return to action at the end of the month. We're very excited about it, and I'm sure she is too. Amber, how are things?
Hello, Marie. How's things with you?
Great. Well, tell us, what is it like being back training? We're envious, and I'm sure lots of people listening as well will be envious of you being able to get out there in the pitch and kick the ball around with your teammates. Simple and all as it sounds.
Yeah, it's been absolutely fantastic to be back. We started full team training yesterday, having been in groups for the last 2 weeks. And it's just, you know, I think even going from two groups training, you know, no contact, you know, keeping social distance to going into full contact, full team training yesterday was just, it was just, I suppose, a dream come true. And it was just long awaited.
And then, Amber, games next Friday. Do you think you've had enough of a lead-in time? How are you feeling body-wise? Are you match ready?
Well, I suppose, Donica, we'll not really know whether we're match ready until the games come about. We can only do what, you know, we've been given, and every team's been in the same boat in terms of how much exposure to training they've got. So we'll do things as best we can. We'll prepare the best way we can. And obviously playing, we have 8 games, I think it is, in less than 5 weeks. So, of course, it will take its toll on the body, but we'll have to manage that as best we can.
And just from a health and safety point of view, what are you doing with temperature checks, with testing, things like that? What's your setup like?
So we don't actually have any of the temperature checks or anything like that. So basically we just have to, of course, if there was any symptoms or any illness, we report that, and then we'd have to stay away until we were tested. We've been tested now. We had our third test there on Wednesday and everybody was negative again. So I think we get retested on either Sunday or Monday of next week. And I think it's just going to be a test a week then until the end of the season.
And Amber, the game itself, like we saw the Bundesliga last Friday and all weekend, but just the process to actually the game, have you run through that yet? Or are you, you know, are you thinking about how you actually, you know, we saw the subs socially distancing, wearing masks. Have you protocols in place for the actual match?
Not as of yet, that we've not been, we've not been made clear of that. I think that that's all to be finalised on Monday. I think there's the meeting with the DFB and the other teams as well. But I suppose it'll be quite similar to how we've seen it over the weekend with the men's game.
And Amber, you're a goal scorer, as we all know. That means celebrations. What are you going to do?
To be honest, I was actually quite surprised when I was watching the game. And I was wondering why everybody was so calm. But I didn't realise that they had to maintain whatever social distancing or whatever for the celebrations. To me, that was a bit of a strange one because there was contact in the game and in the wall. They're in close proximity to each other. So that'll be an interesting one, but I'll have to keep them low-key then.
Yeah. Amber, you mentioned you've been back for 2 weeks kind of in small groups, but getting back with your teammates, like, obviously it's tough for you there picking up the language. How are you settling in?
It's actually not been as bad as I thought. You know, I suppose I used the time away from football to you know, work on my German. And I think coming back in, there's a great group of girls there that, you know, their English is quite good as well. So I've not really had any major problems with the language. That was down to me. I had to put a little bit of responsibility to learn it and more effort into it. And that's something I wasn't really doing before Christmas. But since I've really been, you know, doing it over the last couple of months, I can see a big difference.
Amber, it's not easy being away from home, though. Like, you know, especially when times are tough like they are now and strange. What's it been like for you for the last few months?
Well, I think, you know, since the Montenegro camp, I've been here and, you know, it's just been, you know, it's been a whirlwind couple of weeks, to be honest. And I think for the first few weeks that I was here, you know, I kind of in my head thought, you know, well, I'm going to get home. Like, there's no way that we're going to play because that's what, you know, that's what the stage we were at. But I suppose daily FaceTimes with my mum and my dad, you know, have really, really helped. And I suppose we're lucky that way with technology that we can, you know, we can see people and we can still talk. So, yes, it's been hard, but I suppose for me, I've just tried to use it in a way to, you know, work on things like my German, I suppose, work on my fitness as well while we've been away. And I think things like that has really helped pass the time as well.
Amber, what about Vera Powell? Has she been on? Have you been chatting to each other?
Vera literally just texted me, I think it was this morning, just to wish me all the best for the games next week. Oh. I suppose we're kind of in, we're the only ones really out of the team that look like we're going to be playing, myself, Claire and Diane, of course. So she just literally sent a wee message in this morning just to keep in contact as well.
How did you reply? I'm always nervous when a coach sends you a message. Like, you can't really send the thumbs up emoji. Did you think about it, or what do you do there?
Oh, you never overthink a message to a manager as much as when they send one, especially when it's at 9 o'clock in the morning. You really think you've done something wrong.
So true.
So the thumbs up then?
No thumbs up. Obviously, I had to tell her thank you very much. Of course, you have to keep on the good side. Yeah.
It's good to know that you are going to be playing though, because we're kind of, everything's still uncertain. You don't know when qualifiers are going to come and if they're going to come thick and fast, Amber.
Absolutely. And I suppose for the first few weeks that I was here, I was kind of like, you know, nearly, oh God, I'd really just want to get home at this stage. But I think the closer we got to it and the longer it went on, the chances of us playing and training obviously increased hugely. So of course I'm absolutely delighted to be playing, and it's going to be a busy few weeks. And of course we start off next weekend with Wolfsburg, so no easy task.
Amber, we're definitely looking forward to following you now, because it's so exciting to have people that we know playing in top leagues around Europe, especially when we have no sport here. So you're flying the flag for us all. Fair play.
Thank you very much, Marie.
Thanks so much for joining us. We'll talk to you soon, Amber. Donnie, it is tough being away, isn't it?
Yeah.
Like, you've done it.
Yeah, I've done it. I did 3 years in Worcester, but like, I was living, you know, I was avoiding reality, Marie, whereas Amber's actually chasing her dream. It's totally different. So, yeah, but you're right. It's great now to watch that this weekend and have an Irish interest, because I'll be honest, the men's one went back on Friday and I was interested in one side of it, but once there's someone from Ireland playing, I'm like, all right, now I've... you know, I'm invested and I care.
Yeah, we've Diane Caldwell be playing over there as well, and Clara Reardon. So we'll be checking the results to see how they got on. It is exciting to have our girls doing something on the big stage,
yeah,
for sure.
Absolutely, absolutely. I'm looking forward to the celebrations already.
That's all we have time for, Donica.
Is it? Okay, yeah. Dan Hegarty's up at 10 o'clock and the awesome Tara Stewart's up next.
Live across the nation, this is RTE 2FM.